Okay, so I'm going to flunk my homework assignment if I don't do this first, and then we'll do questions. So what's not? In the chapter 19, Ending Global Warming, which started with the Raisa Gorbachev quote. By the way, show of hands, how many of you have read this? Okay, good. So if you go back and look at it again with these thoughts, I think it's going to help. In it, Ending Global Warming, Stephen says, referring to the Paris Accord, which is a massive undertaking that 195 nations all agreed to change their consciousness about the unacceptable of global warming. That's a huge shift in consciousness. That's good. But then he goes on to say, the language of the agreement not only ratified the 2-degree cap, which is referring to the CO2 cap, but also pointed us toward the more ambitious 1.5-degree target, which would effectively mean getting to a world with zero net carbon pollution by 2050. He goes on to say that goal is bold, but possible. No, it's not. It's totally not possible. We've already shot past the possibility of getting to 1.5. The chance of stopping at 2 is almost zero. Okay? And all the best climate scientists will tell you that. I've been a climate scientist person for about 10 years now. I've published endless numbers of articles on this. I give talks all over the world on it. I'm one of the weird people that actually cares about what the ice cores are at the Arctic and what they say. I actually monitor CO2 on a regular basis as it's captured on Mount Mauna Loa in Hawaii, which is a worldwide monitoring station. I actually trace the thickness of the Greenland ice sheet, not just the height. So I'm really into this in a big, big way, and we publish on it a lot. The bad news is that CO2 is not the biggest problem we face. And if you remember the famous hockey stick that Gore wrote, okay, in Inconvenient Truth, it's like it goes almost straight up. That's a CO2 and heat chart, and it's accurate. And just to give you something scary, we're on the up part now. We're past the shoulder. That's less damaging in terms of heat than methane. Methane is 60 to 80 times more heat absorbing in the atmosphere than CO2. We thought we had a problem when we started seeing methane being released from permafrost, a term we coined to say permanently frozen. Of course, it isn't anymore. And the permafrost has been belching up entire mastodons. The permafrost has underneath it a lot of organic material that's been there for thousands of years, which didn't decay because it was frozen. When it's exposed to oxygen, it immediately decays and it forms methane. If you go online and Google it, you'll see that there have been methane explosions in Russian Siberia, where they literally have taken pictures of huge chunks that have blown up because of the methane release. But that's not the worst problem. The worst problem is the ocean. So when I wrote a book about 10 years ago, the IPCC, which is the international body that tracks climate change, issues a report every 2 years. The IPCC said that there's a CO2 problem. I wrote a book, wanted to have somebody good review it, went to meet the chairman of the United States-Japanese panel. So, and we're considered one of the best panels. In other words, what Japan and the U.S. do in international circles is considered some of the most sophisticated science. And that was headed by a professor named Lawrence Bagard, Honolulu. So I went to see him because I heard about this troubling statistic which occurred right here in Santa Barbara. 10 years ago in Santa Barbara, a group monitoring the ocean right here offshore of Santa Barbara from the Monterey Aquarium, their research division, detected what they thought might be the beginning of methane gurgling up from the bottom of the ocean. And it was pretty scary. So I said the book was already done. We were going to press. I said, we can't. The book was already 560 pages. We can't keep the book open. We've got to go to press. But I'm going to go find out when Professor Bagard reviews the book. I'm going to ask him about this. So I went and saw him. We had this great 3-hour meeting, and in it I got to ask him, Professor Bagard, do you think that's methane that's bubbling up off of Santa Barbara, or is it something else? And he said, well, we don't know. We just don't know. Because Santa Barbara has some very anomalous underwater geography, We're a continental shelf with a steep drop-off. The water on that channel is very cold. It runs very fast. A lot of things that are unusual about Santa Barbara. So we don't know yet. By the way, that upwelling is continuously been monitored to this day by Monterey Aquarium. I said, well, how would we know what it is? He said, well, when you see the second one. 2 years later, the second one appeared in the North Sea. And then they started appearing all over. And what they are what's called hydrate releases. So the oceans have a massive amount of CO2 in them and a massive amount of methane in the form of dead animals. So what happens is to the plankton and the fish, all the things that die, they drop to the bottom of the ocean, and the pressure keeps them there, and then more die. And over millennia, you get these layers of material, just like you do in permafrost. And those layers, those hydrate structures, are kept in place by pressure, meaning how much weight, and temperature, how cold is it. And as the ocean started to warm, the fear became that it will release the hydrates. So that was a theory 10 years ago. It was a proven scientific fact 8 years ago. And just 6 months ago, the largest single catch is a 2,000-mile stream of methane now coming up off the Atlantic seaboard, right off the coast of the eastern part of the United States. There are parts of the Arctic where this is happening so quickly that are many kilometers wide. It looks like fish feeding frenzy. There's so much methane coming up. So, what do we do? In the World Business Academy, we've been studying various ways to alter the climate future. Most of them don't work. Some of them have unpredictable consequences. Only a couple do work. And so far, no government in the world has been working on the ones that do work. And why I'm saying that you can't stop it, too, is because we already have enough methane released today and CO2. I'll give you a very hard statistic. If we had zero CO2 emissions tomorrow morning, it's too late because of the methane. Because what methane does is it then heats up the planet more. So it's like putting a child with a fever in hot water instead of cool. So the methane is heating and heating. And so now it's what's called a runaway. So the planet is now heating itself more with methane than we're heating it with CO2. And the CO2 is just pouring gas on the flame. But if you took the gas away, the flame's still there. Now, can we solve it? Yes. I'm going to give you my favorite quote for more than a decade. I have never heard about, read about, or seen any problem facing human civilization. Never heard about one, read about one, seen one, that cannot be solved with existing technology and resources. Hear that? So we can solve this, but we haven't chosen to yet. Why? I would argue because of the clash of civilizations. Because we haven't gotten clear yet that there is no other, there's just us. And I had this really interesting conversation with Nancy at the break, and I couldn't agree with you more. The most difficult issue we are facing in trying to sort this all out is the abortion issue. I couldn't agree with you more on that. Where you come down on it is probably different, but without a doubt, the biggest challenge. Abortion. She thinks it's a seminal issue to basically everything else that can get fixed. The reason it's important, though, so she and I had an interesting conversation, and she and I have pretty different views. So what I look for with places where we could agree, not where we disagree. And when human society does that as a whole, we will get past this. See, it's like I can't make her wrong because she's the other one who doesn't believe what I believe. I have to embrace that she's a part of me, and I'm trying to figure out how I can work with her to a common solution, even if we have a very different agreement, a different point of view, on one of the most difficult issues that go to everybody's soul level. Okay? So we can't solve climate change today. You remember the Einstein quote? You're never going to solve a problem with the same kind of thinking that got you into it. Okay? So we're not going to solve climate change till we realize that it's going to take a different point of view, and that different point of view is inclusivity. It's the survival of this new holism, this belief that we are one. Okay, now how do we get to this problem? So I disagree with that fact, even though I'm glad he's bringing it up in the book. He's saying that the long-term danger from global warming, in a worst-case scenario, hundreds of millions starving. Wrong. Billions. 5 to 6 billion minimum. And I'll turn to questions in a second. You can ask me how I got that number. But what he goes on to say is he goes on to recommend, page 132, he goes on to say that we should take full personal responsibility translated into public policy. Full personal responsibility translated into public policy. He's right. That's exactly what we should do. So he's right about that. Now, the next thing he goes and talks about is what he calls a climate responsibility fee. Love Stephen, good writer, not a good economist, and doesn't know anything about business. Other than that, so he comes up with a climate responsibility fee, which serious economists, I've taught at Kellogg, I've taught at Stanford, you know, Graduate School of Business, Kellogg School of Business. I've taught at these INSEAD in Europe, and nobody good on the planet thinks that will work that's an economist. Now, how he came up with it, I don't know. But what we do know works, because we've seen it work for over 25 years, is what happened in Alaska. In Alaska, when the government put a tax on carbon, every gallon of oil pumped in Alaska created a fund, 100% of which was paid to the people of Alaska. So every time we took oil out of Alaska, the people in Alaska got paid. And that money didn't go for alternative energy. It just went to the people of Alaska. That type of fee, a carbon tax, which flows 100% of the proceeds back to the public, would be embraced immediately. Ask anybody in the state of Alaska, Democrat or Republican or Independent, do you like the Hawaii tax on fuel? They go, oh yeah, we like that. Because we get a check every year. Now that check's going down because they're running out of oil. It's going down. But they love getting that check. And they don't mind that it was a tax on petroleum. Well, that tax done nationwide, that literally would be a carbon tax, but 100% of the proceeds given back to the people of the United States in a check, would be something you'd have no trouble selling. A carbon responsibility tax, which he's talking about, actually doesn't work. We have a thing like that. He should have studied. In California, we have a cap and trade program. It's not working. Europe has had a cap and trade program. It works marginally well. But a carbon tax is probably the only way to achieve what he's really arguing for. But again, and by the way, in his book, he says, the key to making personal climate responsibility a reality is that we can't rely on good intentions and voluntary choice alone. No. You need to give the money back. Just give the money back. And everybody's going to be with you. So I don't agree with his carbon tax idea. I mean, his cap and trade. It's not practical. And we've seen that now. We've tried it. But the carbon tax with the full rebate to the public has worked very, very well for almost three decades and probably should be tried. Last thing to say about this chapter is he doesn't mention methane anywhere. And it's a bigger problem than CO2. He doesn't mention the albedo effect. Show of hands. Everybody know what the albedo effect is? Okay, he does. Okay. So let me explain real quickly. Whenever sunlight hits the planet Earth and it hits a glacier or any kind of ice mass, North Pole, South Pole, about 83% bounces back into space. And so that doesn't heat us. But it turns out if the ice isn't there, then it goes into the water or the dirt and absorbs it. And it becomes a heat generator. So when you see that there's less ice in the North Sea and they're now taking cruise ships by the North Pole, right, through the so-called inland passage, which could never be passed, that's a bad thing because it means the albedo effect is not happening. In other words, that all that sunlight's not bouncing back. A-L-B-E-D-O. Not mentioned in this chapter. Big miss. I don't want to pick, but there's also another well-documented statistic that deals with fossil or carbon disks. So when carbon goes up in the air from diesel trucks, whatever, it will come down as a speck of carbon dust. And when those specks land on an ice mass, it creates a dot of accelerated melting that's roughly 4 to 5 times its own circumference. Because that little black dot takes more sunlight, and therefore it's radiating more to the ice around it. He doesn't mention what all of us have been doing for the last 10 years, which is measuring the Greenland ice sheet. And we measure it for two things. We measure, well, three things, actually. We measure for how fast it's moving to the coast, and it's now galloping. We measure how much water's coming out of the bottom, because that tells you how much thinner it's getting. And we measure it for actual height as well. And what's happening is the Greenland ice sheet is rapidly going away, and it's changing the complexion of our oceans, as is the CO2. 45% of all of the coral reefs in the world are dead. Those are the lungs of the ocean. It's the lungs of the planet. We just did an event with my friend Jean-Michel Cousteau, who lives here. And we were talking about all these issues, how the oceans literally are dying. And we can get to that more later. Okay, that was that chapter. Let's do this next one quick. Uplifting through microfinance. And he quotes Eleanor Roosevelt, which I thought was great. He talks about an organization called Kiva, great organization. When you read the book, it's real. And if you think you want to provide somebody in the third world, the developing world, with $50 or $100 to start a business, it has a very high success rate of repayment, about 89% repayment rate, even though you don't know this person. And it's a real great multiplier of financial well-being in the worst sectors of the world. I would also urge you, he left it out, I don't know why, go look up Grameen Bank, G-R-A-M-E-E-N, and you'll read about a man named Muhammad Yunus, who got the Nobel Prize. He invented microfinance, so I don't know why it's not in this chapter. Good. So Muhammad Yunus really started it. He's an amazing human being. I have the good fortune of knowing him personally quite well. We had dinner not too long ago. Muhammad Yunus is, and we call him Yunus, if you know him well, you call him Yunus. Yunus is a godsend because he created with $1,500 as a professor the model that now has been followed by Kiva. The other group that he mentions in the book is Finca. I started getting involved with Finca about 25 years ago. Great organization, great way to help change what's happening in the rest of the world. My bio, one of the things that Bob didn't mention, I'm also chairman of the board and have been for a number of years of a group called a nonprofit. It's called Unstoppable. And we have now over 9,000 children in schools in Africa. And we provide clean water so that the girls can be in class, not carry 50-pound jugs of water for 5 hours a day. And we find you can't learn if you have dysentery. So every place we put a school, we put a clean water source. And that all started because of one woman who had a very passionate desire to do something, and she felt she was unstoppable. And I'm really proud to support her. And her name is Cynthia Kersey. And she would come to a group like this and talk, or we get someone here. But what we do is we do things that are parallel to microfinance, but different. They're microeducation. And we do that because we think microfinance is one part of it, and I couldn't agree more with Stephen about that. But education is the huge one, and it wasn't getting done, so we were doing it. Last but not least, he mentions geographic expeditions, where they're inspiring companies to their clients and in other companies to create a different view of how they can support these kinds of micro-lending programs. Couldn't agree with you more. I think it's a great thing to do, and I'm really glad he brought it up in the book. So he talks about Kiva. He talks about Finca. He does not talk about Grameen Bank, but that's really the mothership. And by the way, Grameen Bank now has a very active division for the last 3 or 4 years in the United States, based in New York. He says, and he's correct, microloans are much more effective in a personal form of foreign policy than bombs, and they're far less expensive. He's absolutely right. Chapter 21, The Sacred Corporation, and he quotes Henry Ford, one of my favorite quotes, "A business that makes nothing but money is a poor business." What he says in here, which are really interesting, is he makes a point I made earlier, that corporations have this enormous power, and they can be a force for good. They can be a force for ill. And what he's arguing for in this is if you see the corporation as sacred, it changes your perspective of what you would expect of it. And he goes on to list various attributes of corporations, like it's one of the most efficient engines for creativity, and it's a way to, you know, create a different mixture of capital and labor. It's all good, not particularly deep, but good, and I agree with it. And I don't want to share with you, at one point, he says, this is towards the end of the chapter, the key principle is to transform this aspect of corporate misbehavior. How do you translate, how do you change corporate misbehavior? And he says the key principle is transparency, and he italicizes it. Make it obvious what they're doing. So I want to share something with you which is really interesting. And he calls out for a thing, he calls them conscious ratings tags. Cute idea. It's worth reading. So 4 years ago I gave a speech for Deepak Chopra is a very close friend of mine, has been for 25 years. I'm the chairman of the executive committee of the Chopra Foundation. So we're really close, close friends. And Deepak asked me to give a speech 4 years ago based on the following question. What does it take to shift corporate behavior, particularly Wall Street? How do you do that? I mean, because he knows, Deepak's a member of the World Business Academy and has been for more than 2 decades. That's how we met. And I said, well, Deepak, the only way you can do that is you have to change the scorecard. You have to change the metrics by which corporations evaluate their performance. And therefore, you will then train Wall Street to look for those new metrics as the companies to invest in. He said, well, that's great. Why don't we do that? I said, well, it takes some, that was a quick answer, Deepak. We need a little more time on this. We're not quite ready for prime time on that one, but give it a shot. So I'm getting ready to go up that year to talk on something, I forget what. And I've got a mic on like this, and I'm behind the curtain, and I'm about to get introduced by Deepak. And he said, I changed what you're talking about. What do you mean? He said, I want you to talk about that thing. You called it, you know, Just Capital. I said, no, you called it Just Capital. I explained it. And he said, that's what I want you to talk about. I said, Deepak, we can't do that. We're not ready to talk about it. We just came up with that. He said, yeah, talk about that for 10 minutes. So I did. So we have the videotape of this. Well, here's why it's an interesting story. In November of this year, the cover of Forbes magazine will be Just Capital. What we did is we started a nonprofit. Deepak did it. He pushed me out the door and gave me a kick in the butt, and we said, okay, we'll go make this happen. And we collected some very interesting business people who wanted to change the goalposts, who wanted to have different metrics. We've now conducted 47,000 interviews around America to find out what people in America think would make a just company. And our belief is that when we publish those findings, which we're going to do in November, which Forbes has the exclusive first right to publish, which is why we're on the cover, those rankings, we took the largest 1,000 companies, public companies, publicly traded companies, the largest 1,000 in America, and we rated them. We rated them by how just they were. And the definition of just was what we got from the 47,000 interviews. And there's 15 categories of just. And when it comes out, you won't miss the story because it'll be everywhere. It'll be reported in every conceivable paper you can imagine. And one of my very close friends for many years, who's on the board of Just Capital, and I recruited her, is Arianna Huffington. And Arianna, who's very much a part of this, has committed to getting the word out to everybody who doesn't read financial papers. And she's pretty good at that. So we have a really great mixture of people like Deepak and Arianna. We have billionaires like Paul Tudor Jones, who's now the new chairman. We have a very interesting combination of people on the board of directors, of which I'm privileged to serve, of Just Capital. I'm on the executive committee, I'm on the finance committee, I'm on the audit committee. That's usually where guys like me end up, where the doers and the people with the fancy names are the attractors. And I share that with you because what he's asking for, transparency tags, is now going to exist. And what will be interesting to see if, in fact, we really got what the American public wants to see in corporations. Because if we did, and when those rankings come out, I think it will reflect that we did, people are going to start making choices. So we got a lot of heat. By the way, we got a lot of support, too. Many people on Wall Street are supporting us. The heat we got was there were companies, fossil fuel companies typically, that did not want to be ranked. And they said, it's not fair to compare us to, you know, Microsoft or Google, because we're in a different business. And so, why not? So we cut a deal. That's what business people do. And the deal is, in the first year, we will only do rankings by, you'll be compared to your peers. So is BP worse than Shell or worse than whatever? But in the second year, that comes off. And the reason is you got 1 year to change. But no, in the second year, because we've already designed the ranking systems. And by the way, we spent $5.7 million this year alone just doing the research on this. Just to give you somehow, that's how serious this is. And it'll be probably close to $7.5 million by the time the year ends. So this is a very serious effort by very serious business people to try and identify. Like, you know the college rankings in U.S. News and World Report? Well, whether they're right or wrong, it's a service that somebody put all those rankings together. And so what we're doing is, we're, as a nonprofit organization, we're putting it together. So that will exist. And I will call my friend Stephen and tell him it's called Just Capital. It's not called Consciousness Rating Tags. But he got the right idea. I'm sorry? It's more than hope. Although I've got an advantage over all of you. I was born in Canada. So when we build the wall to keep you out, I'll be on the other side of it. So he goes on to say, when ethical, life-affirming choices become more profitable for corporations than unethical, life-negating choices, corporations will rapidly become the leaders of innovation in every single area of social improvement. I agree. And that's why we did Just Capital. If you wanted to change Wall Street and you wanted to change what corporate behavior was, how do you do it? And the answer is, you change the scorecard. You change the metrics by which they evaluate success. And with public companies, they want customers. And if you, they think you don't like them, you won't shop with them, and no amount of marketing money will save them. So by publishing the rankings, we are changing the goalposts. We're changing the metrics. We're changing the scorecard. Because we thought if it came out in October, no one would read it, because the campaign would sweep us away. We were done, and it's already done. We're sitting on it in a vault right now. maybe not. He goes on to say the federal minimum wage should go up, that it's a good thing. It just, as an economist, I am an economist, absolutely a great thing. And it should be $15 an hour minimum. And here's what your standard should be. No one should have a full-time job in America that leaves them below the poverty line. How can it be morally acceptable that somebody could work 40 hours a week doing anything and be below the poverty line? So I started talking about this a number of years ago. We've had some examples. Seattle went to $15 an hour. Huge success. Economy's booming. Local businessmen love it because there's more money to spend in town. Reduced the amount of government subsidies to the poor. It's actually paying for itself many times over. If you've noticed, there's a great hamburger chain that's very popular under Hamburger Habit. I love to look at their employment signs. They started hanging signs up about a year ago saying, positions immediately available, starting at $9, starting at $8.50, going to $10.50. Today the sign says, starting at $10.50, going to $12.50. Why? Because as the minimum wage has gone up, people no longer have to work for $9 an hour flipping burgers. If you want them to flip a burger, you better pay them $10, $11, or $12. That's a very good thing. And that's what raising the minimum wage does, is it raises the level. Now, does it hurt local business? Absolutely not. The evidence is overwhelming because we live in a consumer economy. So when people have money to spend, they spend it. And it goes to the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. So it turns out in every place it's been tried, it's been a huge success, and yet there's resistance. Why? Because it comes from, I got mine, I don't want you to get yours. It's other. See, it's I got mine, and you're the other. But if I thought, you know, if Ellie's got $15 an hour, I win. That's homo universalis. Right? Me saying Ellie can work for $9, that's all she can earn, that's homo sapiens sapiens. Okay. The last one I was given was chapter 22, and this one's called Transforming Our Banking System. Okay, first of all, there's a term you need to know. It's called FinTech, F-I-N-T-E-C-H. If you haven't seen it, by the way, you notice he quoted Bernard Lethier in the book. Bernard's a good friend of ours, and a member of the Academy, by the way. He's quoted in this chapter. Bernard, myself, a woman named Hazel Henderson, a guy named Bill Sechrist, and a couple other people formed the Advanced Monetary Theory Division of the World Business Academy. Bernard is the father of the euro, one of the people who actually created the euro. Very gifted Belgian professor, and he does all kinds of stuff with us in Santa Barbara and talk later. At the end, why don't you tell them what you're doing? When I finish this thing, and I get any questions, and then come up at the end and tell them about it. Okay, so anyway, love the chapter, FinTech. Financial tech, or FinTech, is a catch-all phrase that's referring to the complete reorganization of the financial system we currently have. And it's happening while we speak. Is it going to happen fast enough? I don't know. Because there's a lot of sickness, as you see in the Wells Fargo situation. A lot of sickness. By the way, for those who don't know, the Treasurer of the State of California yesterday cut Wells Fargo off for 1 year. About time. So I want you to look at the banking system. In this chapter, he thinks of the capital markets system as the banking system, and it's more than that. So the thing I would caution you, it's a part of our financial system. The banking system is not the total thing, and FinTech is what's outside of banking. He goes on to tell you about a book, Web of Debt, by Ellen Brown, which is extremely good. Ellen Brown runs a nonprofit, and it's a very successful think tank that has pioneered the idea of public banking. There's only one state in the country, North Dakota, that has it. It's incredibly successful. It's raised the standard of living in North Dakota. It never crashed in 2008, the only major bank that didn't. It's been a huge benefit to the people of North Dakota. It's called The Web of Debt. And in it, he talks about the Bank of North Dakota. On page 158, he talks about our good friend and a member of the Academy, Bernard Lettier. And Bernard's quote is as follows. We can produce more than enough food to feed everybody. And there is definitely enough work for everybody in the world. But there is clearly not enough money to pay for it all. The scarcity is in our national currencies. In fact, the job of central banks is to create and maintain that currency scarcity. The direct consequence is that we have to fight with each other in order to survive. Homo sapiens sapiens. Not homo universalis. So the alternative, which Bernard would agree with, is a different view, radically different view, of what the banking system should be and what FinTech is about. By the way, the Public Banking Institute is Ellen's organization. I could do this all day. I love agreeing with Stephen, and I love pointing out where I think he got the wrong solution, but he's trying. And I might not be right. You think of what will happen 10 years from today, I'll learn something hopefully where I said, gee, I was wrong then. Now I'm right, because I learned from it. But as long as we're willing to learn, we will get better. And as long as we're willing to commit, we will improve. The question really is, are we willing to work hard enough on our side of this clash of civilizations? Are we willing to work hard enough to create this new species? Are we willing to work hard enough to lubricate the transition from the old species to the new? Are we really willing to do that because we understand that that is the only sacred choice there is? And that would lead to a sacred America. Questions?
Yeah. Come up to the microphone.
How much time do we have for questions?
Well, you got about 7 or 8 minutes.
No. Come on up. Somebody. Anybody?
I'd love to start with one.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I'd love to pick your brain on the subject of health care.
Sure.
If you have anything quick to say about that.
Sure.
Point us in the right direction.
The first thing is, my definition of heaven on earth is when everybody born anywhere on the planet has the following human rights that are inalienable and must be delivered. The first such right would be the right of adequate clean water to drink. The second would be adequate food to eat. The third would be adequate shelter. The fourth would be adequate medical care. I'm going to come back to that because that's your question. The fifth would be the absence of personal violence. No one could beat you up in your home, or collective violence, war. Adequate education for appropriate to where you are on the planet. I would say also a biosphere that is healthy. So an environment that sustains life and that you sustain it. I would also add, particularly in America, although some countries in the world don't agree with this last one, the opportunity for freedom of expression. And that scares some people because that sounds like political expression, which it should include. But at the very least, artistic expression. Every human being should have the ability to express themselves. So if I believe those are the seven fundamental human rights, or eight, depending on how you count them, then for me, the idea of medical care is essential. It's not optional. That we are the only society in the Western civilized world that doesn't provide universal health care is insane to me. It's wrong morally. It's stupid because it's flooding our waiting rooms of our emergency rooms with higher cost alternatives. And I'm very pleased. I was not a big fan of the ultimate solution of Obamacare because I was for universal coverage. I'm lucky, like many people of you in this room, I'm on the ultimate best medical plan. I lived long enough, I have Medicare. Okay, that's single payer, right? And I got Part B. I'm handled. And I'm going, why can't everybody have what I have? Now, I don't have one as good as the Congress has. Theirs is better. But I got a really good one. I've got Medicare. And I love Medicare. I didn't know how I was going to like it. I love Medicare. I'm proud of the fact that 20 million people today in America have insurance that never had it before Obamacare. I'm proud that those 20 million are now not flooding our emergency rooms. Those 20 million are not going to create much worse problems for us socially because they couldn't get healthy. I'm happy that those 20 million people are not one injury or heart attack away from financial destruction. I'm really happy about that. I wish it was the last 15 to 17 million also had insurance, and I hope we can get the single payer. And I can't understand why a 45-year-old who's working hard can't have the same medical program I've got. I just don't understand it. And anybody that tells me that Social Security is bankrupt is not an economist, that's a politician. Social Security is absolutely not bankrupt. And by the way, if it were, which it's not, it'd be easy to fix. Of all the people in this room, how many are on Medicare? Okay. How many of you want to see it terminated or reduced? Okay. I'm not talking about an unpopular political position here. Okay. And last time I checked, we vote. Okay. And I don't understand why we wouldn't trade one B-1 bomber to have Medicare for all. Now, I don't understand that. So that's what I think about Medicare. Next one. Anybody else?
Hi.
Hi.
I love the potential of what you're encouraging us to do. But the skeptic in me is terrified by what I'm observing. Like Risa, I was very impressed with the pyramid of needs that Maslow came up with. And I've observed that when people's needs are even threatened, they don't even have to lose them. Consciousness drops. Right now, Time magazine had an article, Europe is turning ultra-right. Mm-hmm. Even Switzerland. So what can possibly the 1% that are aware of the need to evolve do to stop the tide that's going backwards?
Okay, good. So did anybody see Fareed Zakaria that night?
I did.
Pretty good. I love his show. I tape it if I'm up. I travel a lot. Fareed Zakaria. So he gave this long talk at the Granada. And the thing he missed was what you just asked. He was trying to analyze what happened with this right-wing push. And because he's not an economist, he didn't understand what really created it. So I will share with you. What created this incredible right-wing push in Europe, and I'll come up with what happened in the U.S. in a moment, was Angela Merkel, who is a very capable woman in a lot of ways, believed in a thing called austerity. Because she was living in fear of the past, of World War II, of inflation, rather than feed the economy to create more growth, she decided the way to deal with the economy was to hold it down. So what's happened is Europeans have been going down just like Americans. And so they become very concerned about, well, gee, there's not enough for us. So how can we let these other people in when we're not doing so well already? They're going to take my jobs and I don't have enough job. Okay. So the program, official program, which all economists call austerity, was the decision by political leadership, initially in Germany, but then she got everybody in Europe to do it, including the Brits, including the French, including the Italians. And austerity was the policy of reducing economic activity intentionally. Three economists that I know, two of whom I totally respect, and the third one was me. One was Paul Krugman, one was Stiglitz, and myself have been writing for the last 8 years that austerity would kill us. It's the dumbest thing in the world. It punishing Greece by giving them now, what? They've been since probably 15 years of austerity has destroyed that country and put it on the edge of going completely right wing. It's pushed Germany right wing. It's pushed Switzerland right wing. It's pushed the northern Sweden and Norway right wing. Netherlands right wing. Spain came within, Austria came within less than 1% of basically electing a neo-Nazi. Okay? Now, so this is happening today in real time. Good news. In the U.S., we knew not to do austerity, but we couldn't get the Congress to agree. But because of the crisis before Bush left office, he and the Secretary of Treasury, a Republican former chairman of Goldman Sachs who understood the problem, pushed through, and then eventually Obama got enacted into law, a $750 billion recovery package. That's stimulus. They should have had about $1.5 billion, which is what they asked for and didn't get, but they got $750 billion. What happened was that created a cushion of new business activity. And until about 6 months ago, every month of positive growth of the labor field, so all the unemployment kept trickling down, was a direct result of that stimulus program. And it's why the United States of America has outgrown all of Europe combined. All of Europe combined. And what we just found out, as you know, we're operating at 4.9% unemployment. Okay, 4.9% is what's called structural unemployment. In other words, I change jobs, I'm unemployed for a while. That's structural. It's possible we might be able to get the 4.8, but not likely. So what you're going to see is the hamburger stands like Habit, right? They're going to raise the incoming wage because there's not enough labor now. And I'm predicting you're going to see what's called wage push inflation. You all know about this. That's why I cover my radio show. So that's going to start fairly soon. And the Fed knows it, but they're choosing to let that happen because they don't want to push the economy back down. The good news is, about 6 months ago, the public sector was allowed to start hiring again because tax revenues caught up from corporate behavior. So whereas corporations were doing 100% of the rehiring up until 6 months ago, now we're starting to get public sector hiring. So that's teachers, firemen, policemen. As states like California go further and further into surplus, because we got so much surplus now that even when he got through putting the rainy day fund in, Brown couldn't spend it all. So it's accumulating. And so now you're going to see on the ballot a bond measure. Well, gee, we got all this surplus. Should we, maybe invest something in education again? Because we used to have a good education system, and we took it down when we went broke in 2008, 2009. So the good news is, for the first time in 50 years, we had a distinct increase. I believe it was 2.5% in the average working person's personal disposable income. Hadn't happened since the 70s. So all these years of going down, relative to the poor got poorer, the middle class got to be poor, and the rich got richer. This huge gap that developed since the 70s, for the first time, started to close. And we just got the first statistics on that about a month or two ago. So why do people think the economy's not doing well when we've outperformed every country in the world? Just to give you a number, how fast is the U.S. economy growing right now? Does anybody want to guess? Today, how fast are we growing? I'll give you a couple of yardsticks. Germany is zero to slightly about tenth of a point negative. Britain negative about 2.9. You say pretty close. Yeah, about 2.9. Right now, the only reason we don't know for sure is because we can't tell if that's going to be replicated through Christmas. But if we end up Christmas on the trajectory we're on right now, we will end up at an annualized rate of 2.9%. There is no country in the Western world that's above 1.5. So it's double the next best one. That's how well we're performing. And that's with austerity still in place. What do we need to do to create jobs in America, middle-class jobs? We need to repair our bridges. Okay? We need to repair our roads. We need to have high-speed rail. We're a primitive country. We need airports. We can replace so much air traffic with rail that's less environmentally destructive, cheaper, and cleaner and better. How many of you have been on a European high-speed train? Was that fun or was that pain? That was fun. Okay. So whether the politicians in our state will do high-speed rail correct or not, I doubt. I doubt that they'll do it right, but they'll get it done eventually. You know, we have a subway system in New York that's 125 years old that's literally falling apart. We have a subway system in the District of Columbia that's literally going to have to be closed one leg at a time because it's falling apart. Now, how can you be the richest nation in the world and you can't keep the subways fixed, let alone the bridges? Okay? It means that we have a attitude, Homo sapiens sapiens attitude. Why should I fix the subway that guy rides on? It's my subway. Because we're all one. So Homo Universalis says, hey, what's the most efficient way to get people around? And the answer is, it's not to sell them another car. It's to come up with public transportation. Okay. So when you go down this line of what's created the scarcity conscious we're living with, it's bad government policy. And it's been bad for a very long time. And it got really bad since 2008 because of this thing, austerity. So if you go back and listen to my radio shows in 2008, 2009... what you'll hear me talking about is you'll hear me quoting Stiglitz, you'll hear me quoting Krugman, you'll hear me telling what you can do. And everything that Krugman, Stiglitz, and I said back then has turned out to be true. Austerity is crazy. And I wonderful thing to report to you tonight. I was at dinner with Clinton and my wife last night, and I said, you know, it's gotten so crazy. The Congress just voted a bill which the Democratic Senate stopped, which means the government will shut down in 5 days. And the reason the Democrats stopped it was because they had $200 million in there for a new water system in Flint. And the Republicans took it out. And the Democrats said, if that... And by the way, I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. I'm very, very independent. What the Democratic Senate said was, you know what? If we can't spend $200 million to fix Flint's water system, then we're not a government. That's what government does. So why would we pretend to be a government if we're not going to fix... And it's now 2 years since we figured this one out. And they still haven't repaired the water system. And you know what lead's about? When you absorb lead, as a child, your brain power is permanently reduced. Your agility is permanently reduced. Your neuromotor function is permanently reduced. And there's over 10,000 children in Flint with elevated levels of lead, and probably 100,000 adults. So the Democrats said, if you're not going to do that, okay, we just might as well admit that we don't have a government. Thank God this morning, the Republicans agreed, and they passed the bill. So the government's not going to close after all. And they also put in that bill, the Democrats forced them to put in $1.1 billion for Zika. Can you believe Florida is a Republican state? A Republican state, and they could not get money to stop Zika. That's insane. So that bill now has that. Okay, I got the hook. Thanks, everybody. Oh, one quick announcement. Tell them what you're doing.
Actually, I get a chance to tell you what I'm doing on October 27th, and it builds wonderfully on Rinaldo's talk today about community currencies and the monetary system. It's called Mysticism and Money on October 27th, and Rinaldo is modeled so amazingly for us. When you marry an itinerant monk with incredible economic savvy, there's hope for human universalis. Thank you.
And that was Faye Cox. You didn't introduce her. This is Faye Cox. So Faye has... where's it going to be, Faye?
It's here, Word and Life, October 27th.
Great. So I've known Faye for years. She's worked with the Academy. She's a good friend of Bernard Lettier. And the three of us always get together whenever he comes through town, which isn't often enough. But she's this one of the very weird people who actually likes advanced monetary theory. her, me and Bernard.
And I'm a mystic.
And a mystic. Probably related. Oh, to get the radio show, you go to worldbusiness.org. Worldbusiness.org and go to radio. And when you click on that, every show will be there. There's like a one-line description of what that show's about. And I'll warn you right now, the one I did on September 17th was more dramatic than I usually do. Usually, go back a week or two, it's more practical about investment stuff. Last week, I did a version of what I did today here. Yeah, sure.
Do we ever want to get him back?